Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Game Dev London podcast. Thank you so much for being here. I'm your host for today. My name is Roxanne Marshall, and you can refer to me as she, her. We're talking about something very important today. I feel like I start a lot of my episodes like that. I think everything we talk about is important, but this was something that was, it captured my attention recently. Through Into Games, who are joining us today, and I'll introduce you shortly, about the disparity of people from working class backgrounds working in the game industry. We know that breaking into the industry is already a really tough thing, but there's loads of kind of intersectional things that we really need to think about, and there's a lot that we can do as an industry to do better, which Into Games are really focusing on this year. Deck, I will pass over to you to introduce yourself briefly.
Hello, hi. It's just really nice to be here, actually. Really enjoying it. I've been wanting to come on this podcast for quite a while. I've managed to sneak my way in, so thank you very much. So I'm Declan. I'm the CEO of Into Games. We're an organization that was set up about, I've been saying about 5 years, I think, for quite a while. I think we're about 6 years ago now, actually. It's been quite a while to help create fairer and more equitable pathways into the video games industry for anyone really, so for anyone from any background. Primarily our focus at the moment is those from low-income backgrounds, and that's what I'll be talking about a little bit about today.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about the initiative, how you kind of came to really focus on low-income backgrounds, and yeah, what's it all about?
So I'm from a low-income background myself. So I started kind of working in the games industry at the same time as Into Games founded. So I was pretty green to the sector. But my history is from immigrant parents, my parents broke up at quite an early age. And we were, from a very, very poor background. Both of my parents were kind of fleeing war. Didn't really have any connections or contacts here. And I've got all kinds of parents, all kind of stories from my parents around them kind of working on fun fairs and to survive, and living in garden sheds and doing their homework by candlelight and all the kinds of stuff that seem quite bizarre today. But I have very some of my earliest memories of going from hotel to hotel before we were put in council housing. I'm very aware of what it's like to have nothing, and to also equally know the tenacity and the strength that can come from that as well. So, both my parents are some of the kind of hardest working, strongest people I know. And through this research that we've been doing here, as part of this program, those people are coming up again and again and again. So the story of low income isn't necessarily, one of look at these poor people over here, we need to help them. It's equally look at these incredibly strong, resilient people that have got through a lot with very little. Why aren't they be given the opportunities to thrive as everybody else is? And as I say, this research that we've been doing here, so I'll talk about that in a second, has quite a few wide-ranging outputs for the sector. And I'm not going to claim to be the first to have thrown a light on this area. So this a lot of the idea of getting low income, or saying there's not enough low income people in the sector, originally kind of disseminates comes from the piece of UK census research from 2022, which specifically asked a question around kind of low income working class backgrounds and where people were from. And the stat from that came out, and that stat was picked up by Sam Greer, who is from one of the journalists on People Make Games, and did a fantastic kind of expose video on that last year, which got some people talking. It wasn't as popular as it should have been, I don't think. And I actually spoke to Sam shortly after she released the video, and to say, look, we're doing some work in this area, because we'd started doing little bits and pieces of exploration at that point. And I said, lots of people must have, you must have got lots of interest. You must have got lots of people emailing you about this. And she was like, no, Hardly anyone's messaged about this actually at all from the sector, and I've had people saying it's a great piece of work, and we've had lots of comments, but in terms of people actually reaching out and saying, like, what are we going to do about this? I think I was one of the first, and that was already a month or two after the video released, and it had been kind of fading, in terms of interest after that. So I think at that point it was clear that, look, this is a problem, but who is doing something about it? And it didn't feel like anyone was at that particular point, and still that's the case, So I think we really made that decision internally as an organization to focus on that going forward. A little bit from my own personal background, as mentioned, but the majority of that because there wasn't really anything else out there doing that kind of work, and we felt like there should be. And it's our role as a nonprofit to support people into the game sector and to make it a fairer, more equitable pathway. And if that's not happening for those from low-income backgrounds, then it needs to be. So from our perspective, we started doing work in that area. And the first major piece of work, which hasn't been released yet actually around that, was our difficulty level report. So difficulty level is the kind of general name of the kind of research and practical work that we're doing around this. It started off with a survey late last year. We had almost 300 respondents to that. It's quite a deep survey, so it was, it's one of those things, it takes about half an hour to fill out, so it wasn't high level. It was a lot of information that we garnered from people from that, and that was aimed specifically at people who had made it in the sector. So they'd got jobs in the sector, but they'd come from a low-income background. So we wanted to map and explore what the barriers and challenges were for those people specifically, so we could then create recommendations and bits and pieces that we could then send out to policymakers and the industry to give some practical advice and next steps of, okay, so what are we going to do now? Because you speak to the industry about this kind of stuff, and of course, we're human beings, they want to do better, but without the advocacy groups there, that's not where the push has been, and quite rightly there's been pushes for more ethnic, sorry, more genders in games, so a more diverse range of genders in games, a wider range of ethnic minorities in games, various other bits and pieces, lots of stuff around neurodivergence in games. But I mean, you're hard pressed to find anything about low income anywhere. And underlyingly, when you start peeling back the layers, you find it underpins a lot of these other areas, So it's not something that stands on its own as well. It kind of weaves in and out of a lot of these other areas, So from that perspective, from my perspective, it's fascinating, because you get to kind of dive into the research around this and look more deeply around not just the game sector, because a lot of research has been done around this in other areas and other sectors. So there is research around this in the creative sectors more broadly. And the difficulty level research we've got coming out does pull from some of those reports and papers that have been written in the last kind of 5 years, around. There's one called Create a Majority, which is a fantastic, fantastic report, that nominally I think Yuki were kind of part of in a small way, but when you read the report, and there's not really much about games in there at all, but it's mainly about TV and film, and you get that a lot. There's a lot of great research around TV and film out there. There's a lot of great programs out there for TV and film, actually, for those from low-income backgrounds. But you don't get any of that mirrored in games as much, for that particular area. So it's been nice kind of picking and choosing and finding and doing that piece of work there. And funnily enough, I'm an apprentice, so I'm a level seven team leader, doing apprenticeship currently. Which I was really keen and excited to do because I was a university dropout and I really wanted to go back to university in some way. And this particular apprenticeship is being delivered at my local university, at Brighton University. So I got to go back there, and it converts into a master's and stuff. So it's nice going back to that kind of world. But it is really nice timing because it means I get access to all of this research that the university has. So I've got the password codes for, all this next level of research that I can pull into the reporting that we're doing at the moment, and have something that's really well referenced and feels like a kind of a solid, powerful bit of practical work that we can take forward, I mean, we're at a stage now where that report will probably be released at some point in the next couple of weeks. But of course, a report is just a report, it doesn't A lot of reports sit there doing nothing. And we've been a lot of things, but certainly, you could say we're a lot of things, but I think we've always been a very practical organization. To a fault, I think, sometimes, and through some of our programs have been too overreaching, and us as a small team haven't been able to deliver on this, some of the wider aims and goals that we'd like to have. But certainly, whatever we've done, we've always been like, let's see if this works in reality. Let's go and do this rather than just talk about it. And I think, from that perspective, we kind of ended up leaping ahead of the report and releasing our game plan for 2024 at the start of January, which was a kind of list of activations and activities that we would like to see happen over the next 12 months, specifically around an internal framework that we use. So we've got kind of a five-pillar framework that we use to denote the projects and also the journey of people on their way from understanding about a career in games to getting a career in games. That's very useful internally when we're, planning future programs and understanding how to evaluate these programs, because we can evaluate them by which pillar they're in. And those five pillars are inspire, guide, nurture, hire, and ignite. And they follow a process of I say finding about the sector to actually then getting into the sector and then wanting to help people get back into the sector. So it's kind of a cyclical framework. But we mapped out what we wanted to see the movement in terms of those from low-income backgrounds coming into sector and the practicalities around that to that framework, and then released that framework under the kind of game plan 2024 idea at the start of Jan. So that's kind of out there. That's our initial kind of these are the practical activities we'd like to see, but we're now hoping to kind of back that up with some solid research that can sit behind a lot of that stuff and hopefully unlock some further opportunities and further funding potentially, and further other collaborations that can then we can build around that as we go forward.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I think it's a really great initiative. I mean, you reached out to me when you had first, were promoting it, and the kind of statistics in there just really caught my attention. So I think it's going to be a really, really great year. Hopefully we can get some people involved. And yeah, I want to talk a little bit about, for people who kind of haven't experienced these barriers, particularly that people from low incomes face, how does this show up in reality for people who are kind of trying to get into the industry? What is happening that's stopping people get in?
So the research puts out a few things. Firstly, we are the worst out of all the creative sectors for people from low-income backgrounds coming into the sector. So that's a bit of new information that wasn't really there before. So certainly we knew the number from the UK Census, but we hadn't compared that directly with other sectors before, and we are the worst. So that's a big thing that we shouldn't necessarily be very proud of. Specifically the barriers and challenges. So it kind of emerged that there were a few thematic areas that came out of this. And I don't think many of them will be a total surprise. A lot of these things aren't. I mean, there's a kind of tacit knowledge about this kind of stuff. But the areas that kind of came out were cost as kind of a prohibitive factor. Location, having to work while studying. I mean, this doesn't happen maybe as much in games as it used to, but certainly when a lot of the people that asked were going through their journey into the sector, unpaid internships were a thing. They also mentioned kind of low pay entry level as well. So that still is a thing. So this, still low pay is still a thing at entry level, even though entry-level expectations have gone up dramatically over the last 5 years, in that I think compared to most other organizations, an entry-level person in games is probably an intermediate in another sector a lot of the time. Lack of support and guidance is another kind of theme here. And then finally, kind of this is quite interesting, kind of socioeconomic bias. So a lot of the people that we asked genuinely felt an othering. I mean, it's debatable whether those things are more on the person, and there's certainly some research to say that If you're from a low-income group or working-class group, certainly in this society, there is a sense of shame associated with that. And that shame can induce feelings of paranoia and self-othering sometimes. A lot of the people that we asked said that wasn't the case, and actually that they would point to very specific circumstances where they had been othered. And there were a few examples of that taking place in studios or during the interview process or at university, certainly places that made them feel like it was a less inclusive place to be, and that they were somebody else other than the right people that were supposed to be there, So that's a very real thing that's happening for a lot of people that are going through this thing. The main thing that was talked about here is financial barriers, right? That's the biggest thing here. And of course, we're talking about low income, we're talking about people from low socioeconomic groups. This is, that's the main issue. So that affects in a few different ways. So it might be that people can't afford to go to conferences or industry events or any of the kind of things that you go to any talk. And God, into games, we've hosted a few of them. Certainly, you have hosted a few of them as well, around how to get into the games industry. And networking and going to the events is always there. It's always one of the things that you have to do. So the travel costs for those, can affect people so quite severely. I mean, in addition to that, we're working on doing some bits and pieces around this currently. But there's also the additional cost of doing kind of extra courses outside of university. Extra tuition, extra skill development, the inability to invest in equipment, that enables you to do the thing that you want to do. And interestingly, university can be or could be a really great leveler when it comes to some of these things. Certainly when it comes to equipment, you can get access to that at university. So that's brilliant. You've got 3 years of that. So you can build up your stuff there. When it comes to boosting your network and doing that kind of networking, universities can bring in people into the university and make that kind of stuff happen. But again and again, once again, you'll see in those same get into games talks, university isn't enough. You have to be doing stuff outside of university as well. You have to be doing the extra game jams. You have to be doing the extra courses. You have to be doing all this extra stuff. And as I just said, that there's one of the thematic areas here is working while studying. It's very rare that if somebody's got to the point where they are studying games, which in itself is that's a minor miracle in itself that they've decided that and they're making that commitment and that's what they're going to do and they're taking it to that extra higher education level. They're on the pathway. It's very rare that those people will not have to work while studying. And so that effectively takes away all the extra time that they've got to do those extra bits to get them hired in the sector. So all they're doing is the university work as it is, which we've already mentioned isn't enough. So, you can take people right down the line, and these kind of various factors are going to still affect them right up to that point. Even when they've left university and they're like technically ready to go, which is what I think a lot of universities want them to be. But I mean, I don't know how true that is these days, due to the high expectations at entry level, they haven't got as much work as their peers. The they personally might be fantastic, but you need time. That's all. And then time is a more precious commodity. And if they haven't had that because they've had to work, or because we had some other examples in there of people have had to care for their families, because of physically and emotionally, and of course all of those problems are often exacerbated from low-income backgrounds as well. If certainly mental health is a big problem, and there's a lot of studies around that as well. You haven't got the time to do that work. You haven't got the time to go and go to those events. So you're already at a massive disadvantage compared to the X thousands of people that are coming out that haven't had those similar problems. So let's say you go for all of that. And once again, through some minor miracle, you managed to get hired, or not even a miracle at that stage, that you're just really good. You're just bloody good, right? And all of these issues and problems, you've gotten over them. And this, then there are lots of people like this, and you've got hired. And at that level, you're living in London, and the pay just isn't enough, you know. And you've got other people that you need to support with that pay. And then you're suddenly trapped in a position where you've got the job that you wanted and set out to do, but it's and you've studied a long time to get there, but it's not paying you enough. And then suddenly, you're almost in the same cycle that your parents or carers or whoever were previous. It just happens that you're in one of the kind of most, one of the sectors that's going to be the most demanding of you and your skills for at least a certain period of time. And then you might get fired anyway because, hey, it's the game sector and things aren't all rosy at the moment. So, I don't necessarily, this is the kind of sad bit of all of the report, or at least certainly the most real. And I, there's a whole bunch of different recommendations and things that you can pull out from this stuff. We just have to be real about them. We just have to admit it's happening. And we have to obviously want there to be some change. And interestingly, the game sector itself has a real history of people from low-income backgrounds succeeding in it and growing the sector. This is the UK kind of boom, and the reason why we have a game sector that's so good these days is because, back in the early 80s, you had young people in their bedrooms, many of them from low income, many of them have begged, borrowed, and stolen some BBC Micro from somewhere or whatever, and managed to, work on, creating games very cheaply in their bedrooms, to get a bit of extra cash. There is loads of examples of really high level people in the games industry now, leaders of some of the biggest studios going, who have those humble beginnings and are from low income backgrounds. And there is this punk DIY ethic of just getting it done and getting it done rough and ready and cheaply and making it happen because you had to get some money, I think that's a really exciting, interesting place to look at, an inspiring place to look at it from. But of course, now there's so many layers of technology in the way and so much expectation and all these other bits and pieces. But I don't know, my personal belief, and what I can see happening now in the kind of the slow collapse of large, big studios and kind of AAA gaming kind of generally on the horizon, think there's scary things happening around all those areas, is actually, a fall back to more of that DIY ethos, a fall back to smaller games, a fall back to people, being empowered and having access to the technology they need to make the thing that they want to make and to make it. And a whole new, kind of range of indie developers kind of making themselves known and coming back, and mid-tier games, mid-level, double A games, for want of a better term, coming back in, and I can see that future happening. I can see the industry repairing. It goes through booms and busts all the time. There's a fantastic book on that, Press Reset, which literally talks about this exact same thing and was written a few years ago. This it will get better again, but I think this particular challenge hasn't changed. We need to do something about this now to empower that next range of creators, and we need to, and the biggest studios need to understand that this is a benefit to them, and there's a reason why they should be doing this. I got lost there, off track for a bit, talking about
No,
the
that's great.
80s. Sorry.
No, I think I've definitely seen that. I've been talking about that a little bit recently, that this kind of boom of the indie, the solo dev just creating these games are just exploding, and I think it's a really special thing that hopefully does continue, because that barrier to entry is so hard that people are doing it themselves. But as you said, not everyone has the technology to do that, the time to learn how to do those things, and that is a big barrier in itself. Even having, a console to be able to play a game now is so expensive that that's a barrier before you even know if you want to make games to play them in the first place. So
Absolutely.
even though things like mobile
Absolutely.
are making it slightly more accessible, that's still a big problem. I don't want to go too much into the people impacted because it's not their kind of problem to solve. But I wondered if you had a bit of a view on like how people who are impacted, how people from low-income backgrounds can kind of prepare to be making these moves into the gaming industry or trying to get there.
Yeah, I think it starts with dropping the shame around it. Dropping the shame and stigma around it is a big part of that. I think that can be something that holds people back quite a lot. In fact, it can sometimes be the only thing that holds people back is the fact that they don't think they're good enough to be somewhere. And I'd say, it's the sooner that you can try and get past that and realize you are as good as anybody else and deserve 100% to be in that room and that space, then you can then really start building the mental tools to be able to take yourself and propel yourself to the next stage that you need to be at. But I would say foundationally, that's the beginning, and that's also the, sadly, the place that a lot of people from those backgrounds are starting at a lower level are at. And have to come into a room and just immediately maybe feel a little bit less than everybody else in there. And that's coming from my personal perspective as well. It's taken me a long time to be able to feel as good as everybody else, so I would say that's probably that's what people should be working on. And I guess there's a few ways that you can work on that. I mean, not everybody has the money for therapy, although I would thoroughly recommend that as an option if you can get access to that through, through, I mean, well, you used to be able to get access through the NHS, but maybe not so much anymore. Certainly if you're at university, there are options of getting access to that kind of mental health care through the university process. And I'd really suggest doing that kind of work. Putting yourself out there is a really great way of doing that kind of stuff in small ways. Not doesn't need to be big, massive ways, but writing a regular blog about your knowledge and what you're learning, and commenting and having something to say about what's happening currently, and just kind of ingraining yourself within the narrative and the conversation of things in small ways, I think is another way of slowly building up your confidence and building up your let's just say your kind of framework of who you are and where you're at and where you'd like to go. Being realistic, being systematic about what you're doing, I think is a really good thing to do. And this isn't advice just for people from low-income backgrounds, but we get sent God knows how many portfolios and people asking for help, all the time, every day. And I would say that very clearly, 99% of the people that send us their stuff are immediately not ready and would be immediately rejected by a recruiter. And there's no two ways about that. And so understanding what good looks like is another first step, so that you can plan your learning journey from there, and not get to the point where you feel constantly. Where you, because that's another thing, it can kind of feed into itself. So if you're starting from a point of feeling less than everyone else, you go through university or some kind of learning process, you've been told by society or by the education provider that you're ready, and that you start sending your things out, and of course immediately you get a bunch of rejections, and that can then send someone lower. And then it can be much harder to come up from that lower place again to a point where they're ready to do stuff. So I think before you start sending stuff out, just be super clear that you're ready. And we just launched something once again at the start of this year. It's called the Entry Level Skills Hub. So you can go to entrylevel.games. And we did this in collaboration with an organization called Bird's Eye View. What we did there is essentially taken every single entry level role, pretty much. There's a few missing there that we'll update soon, but taken pretty much every single entry level position, gone and spoken to dozens of hiring managers, people who are juniors in that role who've just been hired, and mapped out the knowledge, behaviors, and skills that are needed for that particular role based on what that actually is. And then we've also attached CVs and portfolios of people who've just been hired in those junior roles. So, I would say that's just an incredibly basic, simple tool, but I think that it was something that didn't necessarily exist before in any clear format anywhere. So I would use that tool to then judge yourself by and go, okay, look, I'm not quite here yet. Here's where I potentially could, this is what I could do to kind of get there. Use a bit of AI tutorage, understand where you're at, use that as a free tutor to kind of build up a system of learning for yourself. But I think understanding where you're at and being honest with yourself is step one, as well as kind of then building the confidence around what you're doing. Because I think if you start putting yourself out there and you're not fully confident in your work and you kind of know in the back of your head it's not right, but you're like, what else am I going to do? Then you get stuck in a really dangerous place that isn't going to push you forward. It's going to pull you back. And you're going to get sadder and sadder. And that's going to feed into whatever else you've got going on as well around your background and where you're from. So, that's generally the foundational point that you want to set off from. And then you're in the same boat with everyone else, in which is it's difficult. It's hard out there. Then you've just got then you're just back to where everyone else is, and it's like, God, what do we do now? And then the same kind of advice that we usually give on these kind of things applies. But understand what good is, and give yourself some love. That's it.
Yeah, I think that mindset point is really important about just kind of self-reflecting and not just necessarily saying, I'm not quite ready for this, but what are the great things that you can bring? What makes you unique? And I mean, there's been tons of studies now that show diverse workforces are better, perform better when you have ideas from different experiences. We collaborate better, we make new ideas, and we cater to more people. So there's so much value in everyone who is in this situation, no matter your background. And to be able to identify those really strong points that you have, which we will all have, is such an important place to be. But yeah, it's tough. It is tough out here. Once you get past that, it's tough anyway. So, but
Yes.
for anyone listening, you've got this. We believe in you. Very quick one about what employers can do to be better for people with low income backgrounds, how they can be more conscious or kind of have less bias around this cohort of people.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think I suppose it's first mapping it, right? So it's admitting that it exists as something to be mapped. So, having it as something, and there's some very good examples of the exact questions you should ask, mainly based around the occupations of your parents. Is how it's normally checked, but of course you can ask whether someone was on free school meals, another good way of checking, but there's a few questions that you can ask during the application process for any role that would enable you to then understand the background of people as they're employing and understand the people if you decide to employ them once they're there. And I think that's a good first step to do, and you can do that in some really safe and positive ways. So I think that's the main thing. I think that making roles as accessible as you possibly can is really important. And a lot of studios do a lot of that work, but when it comes to outreach, I think things could be a lot more targeted. Certainly there's a lot of great studios doing good school outreach work. And we help a lot of studios do good school re outreach work with the video games ambassadors, but it's not very targeted. So inevitably, a lot of the kind of open studio days and work experience events and various bits and pieces that some, let's say, some studios, great studios do, they end up bringing in the people who would have got them anyway. So it's the people that would have found out about them and. Some parent would have found out about it and then, made sure their kids got onto it, and it was a friend of a friend from the studio. And I don't think it's, this is obviously not on purpose, but it comes with doing outreach work while also trying to run a game studio. You're not going to be able to do, you're not going to be able to go and perfectly run schools outreach work because that's not, that's not what your job is. But you're well-meaning enough to want to do that work. So I think there's some more focused work around that and working with local grassroots organizations that already work with young people at that earlier stage. And another thing that the report surfaced was the age group that interventions were deemed to be the most useful. This is directly from the sector professionals already in the sector, and I'm sure we cross-reference that with a few other reports in our report. But that age 16, 15, 16 bit is really important, as you would imagine. So ensuring that there's enough guidance and options at that point and enough connections to the sector is a really good time to be doing that kind of work, and ensuring people can see games as a kind of endpoint. So if studios are going to be doing outreach work to schools, I would just say that, putting low income or targeting low income schools specifically would be a good idea. So adding that to the kind of wider repertoire of what they're doing, I think is good. I mean, connecting with a directly connecting with the university as well for a studio, I think, is always a good idea. There are a lot of studios that have good relationships with universities, not enough. I would say that's often the university's issue as well as the studios. It's not the studio's job is to make games. The university's job is to prepare students for work and to make sure they're ready. So I think that there's a big part of that process that needs to be on the studios, sorry, the university's doorstep, to make sure those partnerships are there and make sure those partnerships are rich and fulfilling for the studio, so they're getting the best talent directly to them. So there is a clear connection between those two. As I say, some universities do it brilliantly. Some universities, or the majority of universities, I would say, probably don't do it as well as they should do. But within those universities, that's another really good touch point for those from low income, because the universities know who's from low. Know who's from low income. Often they've been doing widening participation work. Widening participation is the name of the outreach work that universities do into low income areas to bring more people from working class backgrounds into the higher educational system. And so often they've kind of got them marked down within the system. And actually, this is another thing. It's quite the kind of tracking of people is difficult, right? Because you're kind of tracking them through all these different programs and educational processes and all these kind of different things. So it's really important to kind of keep that mapping up, just so who's the right person to give the right support and interventions to give them the support they need. And I'd say that once again, if a studio does work with a university, to not just look at the talent they're going to get in terms of, the quality of how well people can do the job. That's probably a bad way of putting it, because I think actually everybody from who's going through these processes can do it to the same level if they really want to. But more like, what's their widening participation strategy at university? What does that look like? I'd say to inquire about that. And to be like, okay, well, can we help or support with that? Or, can we, bring in a speaker into a secondary school you're partnered with? So can we, just to have it as something to talk about. And I think overall, this is the thing. We just need to bring this conversation much more into the open, and make it an important thing for us all as a sector to do, to talk about going forward. And, universities are part of bringing that forward, studios are part of bringing that forward, and, groups like InterGames, who I guess we're slowly becoming the advocacy group for this group. I'm not saying we didn't set out to become that, and there might be other organizations that might be better placed to do that work in the long run. But certainly, as a kind of initial piece of work, that's where we're going. So yeah, I think studios can probably do a few things, but it's an evolving conversation, So I think InterGames, whether we necessarily want to or not, we certainly felt like we kind of have to. We've become a bit of a driving force around pushing this stuff forward. And I think we were talking a little bit about what studios should do, so what they could do. And I think there's a few bits and pieces I talked about, but I think that internally, we talked about the internal mapping of and finding out just, who in your organization is from a low-income background, means that you can then give them a seat at the table. So you can then, you can take them and take the information that they've got and use that to kind of map long-term internal processes to ensure that when somebody does apply from a low-income background, that maybe, you know where they're coming from. And also that you could then advertise jobs in the right places to ensure that there's a broad range of people applying. And I think having that knowledge as well kind of means that you can be more understanding as an employer when certain issues might happen, certainly around kind of challenging home situations. And just having that knowledge there, I think just makes it somewhere safer for that person to work,
Sure.
So yeah, I mean ultimately, I suppose what we're saying right at the beginning of all of this was that a lot of the people that come from these groups are probably going to be the probably going to be the most solid, tenacious, brilliant people at their jobs. So I would my personal feeling is I would look at it as a massive benefit. Like I think understanding that somebody has come from a low income background, and has work that's good enough to get them hired means that they have come a hell of a long way and have probably, probably worked harder to achieve what they've got. And you want someone like that on your team, so it should be a badge of honor rather than something that maybe people find a little bit shameful. Actually, it should be the complete reverse of that. So I think there's a benefit to looking at that too.
Yeah, for sure. I'm completely with you. I mean, a lot of people I know from low income backgrounds are some of the most incredible people I know, like you mentioned, in terms of just the hard work they put into things and the care. And yeah, we need to do better, and hopefully, the work that InterGames are doing is will really shift the dial. I think that concludes today's episode. Where can we learn more about what you're up to, and how can we follow along with what InterGames are doing this year?
So you can go to intergames.org. We've got a new shiny website coming out in hopefully like a month's time, which I'm so excited about. I am so happy to say goodbye to our kind of 4-year-old website now and move forward loads of exciting stuff. So go there, go to our Discord. So you just go to intergames.org/Discord and you'll get an invite from that. Once again, we've just got a new community manager. So we'll be running kind of weekly talks and competitions and all kinds of stuff on there in the next few weeks. So definitely head over there. Just sign up to our mailing list and get involved. And if you're a studio or if you're a sector professional that wants to do more, then sign up to the Video Games Ambassadors. It takes 5 minutes, really easy way of going and volunteering your time to go and do lots of cool stuff, often very close to you. And just get in touch and say hello. I like talking to people. We all do. So come and say hello and get involved with what we do. We've also, if you'd like to give us some money, that's also a nice thing to do. We are a non-profit organization. This is all funded through various different ways, but our game plan 2024, which relates specifically to the low-income work that we're doing, is currently being funded. So if you do go to Intergames, I think it's intergames.gameplan2024.org. And you can see that there, and you can bung us some dollar to go and do some good work.
Thank you so much, and thank you for chatting with me today. I'm a massive advocate of InterGames for everyone listening. They helped me get where I am, and I'm super thankful. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the rest of this year and the campaign, and seeing some more amazing things. So thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be here. Lovely to speak to you. Thank you.
Catch us every Monday. Our episodes launch. Follow us on gamedev.london, pretty much everywhere, YouTube, Spotify, and everywhere else. I've been your host, Roxanne. You can follow me if you dare. I'm Roxanne Fox on most things, and we'll catch you on the next one.